when I'm here. The last lecture which I deliver is called the Mary Hinderly Lecture. So consequently, Mary and I met about 3 weeks ago, and we decided that I should talk about two kinds of people who only, not only now, but also it seems throughout history, have not been heard from, and who tend either to get ignored or to get taken advantage of. The first kind of person is the common man, the ordinary everyday guy, of whom there are a great many present in this room this morning. The other one we call the uncommon man. And this is the highly unusual person, the person with great talent in the arts, the sciences, literature, and so on. And so Mary asked me to plead for the common man and for the uncommon man this morning. So I thought about it for a while and decided that the best way to do it was to plead their cause in the form of free verse, which I have done. And I used as a sort of foil one of Mary's favorite enemies, Friedrich Nietzsche, and the Superman. The Superman is the enemy of the common man and of the uncommon man. Friedrich Nietzsche and the late 19th century developed the theory of the Superman and suggested that what man should turn his attention to is the development of the Superman. The way to produce the Superman would be by everyone turning against everyone else, by having constant warfare, and as a result of this, the Superman would evolve. It would be a superior being, superior to mankind. And so consequently, I'm talking against Nietzsche on behalf of the common ordinary man, and on behalf of the extraordinary man. And I call it cries beyond utterance because we don't hear from the common man. His voice is not heard. We call him the silent majority. And the uncommon man tends not to complain when he's taken advantage of. So I call it cries beyond utterance, the anti-Nietzsche against the Superman. Now, you will note that most of this is devoted to the common man, which I suppose is appropriate because there are so many of him. And the first part is kind of organized and moves along rather coherently. And when I got to the uncommon man, I discovered that I probably should treat him uncommonly. And so there are little sparks and flashes going off this way and that way. I hope that you catch all the allusions. Some of them will fly by rather rapidly. If you smile at the right places and laugh at the right places, I'll notice that you've caught the illusions. If you don't, I'll know I blew it. I have to put in footnotes. But I do have to mention, too, that coming fairly early in the game, I'll make reference to Cain's wife. And, of course, nobody knows who Cain's wife was. You know, in one of the old theological debates was, where did Cain get his wife? And I'll make reference to Cain's wife, you know, who we don't know. She's one of the common men. Yeah, I'll also refer, the nobodies of life. And I'll also refer to the men who worked for Tubal Cain. And Tubal Cain was the guy who had the coppersmiths and the blacksmiths work for him. And I'll speak on behalf of the coppersmiths and the blacksmiths. Okay, so there are a couple of allusions that I'm tipping you off to ahead of time. This will take about 15 minutes. I sing the song of the inarticulate. I cry the call of the mute. They whisper, they contort their faces, they weep. But the Superman, articulate, vocal, the man without ears and the man without eyes, contemplates himself, heedless that the soft and yielding ground on which he treads, the clay he shapes to fashion out his destiny, is other men. And so I sing the song of the common man, and the song of the uncommon man, the pushed down and the pushed aside. I glory in the nobodies, the never were anythings. I care for those who fall between the hated and the loved. I love the taken for granted and the never noticed. I remember, for instance, with fondness, Cain's wife, and all the nameless men who struggled to build Cain's first city. the coppersmiths, the blacksmiths who labored under Tubal Cain, all the nameless hordes who subdued the early earth, built its houses, reared its walls, invented its plumbings, and laid the roads and walks. I remember their blisters and their sores. One had a headache. He never complained, and no one ever knew. But I know, for I remember the common man. I rubbed his aching muscles. I took pride in his brave strength as the cities rose from the earth. Others' names got carved on the city gates, but the common man carved the names. Working from a scholar's clay, working just so, to make every mark and every stroke to correspond, writ large, yet writ true, marks of great significance he knew, magic marks. How magic, though, he could not tell. He could not read a stroke. The centuries roll on. Great men shape their times, carved out of the life and fortunes of the common man. Great Darius sought to rule the world. The common man of Greece opposed and won and lost his commonness. As he for such a little time sought greatness, believed his poets, followed his politicians, risked his all against an uncommon man of Macedonia and lost. And then two edges of the world began to churn at once. Yet enough there was of earth between to separate the rumbles for better than 1,000 years. Rome rose and fell. China rose and endured. Between Rome and China's tumult, lived and labored and died the common man. He lived in tribal groups, none so big as caught the passing glance of visiting historians. Mighty Caesar fought the common man, took Vercingetorix to Rome, and left behind the common man to till his fields in peace, until he took into his head to visit Rome. Rome died upon his pagan lance. After Rome, there came the age of the common man, left largely on his own. And because it was his age, men called it dark. The nobles fought the wars, pressed back the invaders from the east, and made the history books. The common man toiled and wed and bred and said his simple prayers. The common man invented the cathedral, monument to an unknown builder, dedicating their simple talents to a complex task. Their multivarious penchants gave variety amidst the unity of faith in those lightly massive piles of pious stone. The common man endured. The cathedral is his monument. Empires rose and fell aside to reveal beneath the common man. Where is the learned Greek? Where is the noble Roman? Where are the haughty emperors and kings? None survive. Only the common man. The modern world invented a new man, the Superman, the man who is neither common nor uncommon. The man who is neither common nor uncommon used the uncommon man and blamed the common man. The common man has always been used. He knows that. His long history of endurance shows that. His consolation and his pride have always rested on his talent to survive. He carries in his vitals the seeds of all future human life. For supermen, you see, are sterile. The common man carries in his peasant heart a faith in man and God. And if he cannot comprehend the ideas on which science and society are built, he knows the common virtues of house and home and family on which a restless humankind depend. Before our modern day, the common man was never blamed. He may have suffered other slights, but he was never blamed. For after all, he was the common man. The common man has always sought to be self-sufficient, honest, self-reliant, dependable, anonymous. The common man has always been uncomplaining, numerous, vulnerable. Modern man invented a new game. Get the common man. Does the state need an army to conquer the world? Draft the common man. There are a lot of him. He doesn't complain. He can take it. Tell him it is his patriotic duty. Does the state need money to finance its foolish fancies? Tax the common man. There are a lot of him. He won't complain. He's got it. He's been saving. He'll get by somehow. Tell him it is the cost of citizenship. Is there injustice in the land? Are there minorities which are oppressed? Blame the common man. He'll feel guilty. He won't complain. He lives next door to them in that low-cost house he spent a lifetime to afford. He can't fight back. Tell him he's a bigot. Is there a depression in the land? Fire the common man. Tell him he'll get another job very easily. Write him a reference. Honest, dependable, likable, expendable. Tell him he's just too old. If he has a bad government, tell him he's got it coming. Everybody knows the common man always gets what he deserves. That's why he's so common. If the morals of society get out of whack, point the finger at the common man. Ridicule his squareness, his law-abidingness, his downright middle-classness, his conventionality, his dullness. Oh, common man, you are so ordinary. Well, the common man listens and he suffers. And he wonders in his bewilderment what he's done to deserve all this abuse. And he tells himself, haven't I tried to be a good soldier? And now war is wrong. Haven't I tried to be a good citizen? And now tax dodging is the thing. Haven't I tried to be a careful voter? I believed everything they told me. Haven't I tried to make my own way and not be a burden to anyone? Then why am I so wrong? And he tries to cover his hurts with a tough skin, an expressionless face, and sometimes a sullenness to drive off his attackers. He won't cry. But for those unshed tears, I sing the song of the common man. I feel his pain. I reel in his bewilderment. And I am nobody with his nothing. I love the common man. Fear the wrath of the common man. He suffers taken for grantedness, contempt, abuse, oppression, manipulation for centuries. And then, like a somnolent volcano, he bursts out in revolution. Rome, France, Mexico, Haiti, Cuba. And then there is hell to pay as the heaped-up resentments of 1,000 years wash over the very important people, the establishment clergy, the legends in their own times, the aristocracy, and the very best people. Anger surges over the land, burning, destroying, and killing. Terror stalks the cities as the common man wreaks his vengeance until glutted with the blood sacrifice, he sleeps, harmless for another 1,000 years. I sing the sorrows of the uncommon man, the out-of-time man, who marches to the drum of the next generation and the century to come. I plead for the too-soon man who labors in the loneliness of misunderstanding. He's out of home in a pragmatic world for all that he can offer are masterpieces. And masterpieces don't sell until the next generation. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Vincent has lost one to his art. Mozart, write me a tune, make it catchy so I can swoon. Show me a poet who can live by his art and I will show you paradise. The uncommon man cannot escape public notice. He's different. He has talent. He dreams dreams. Act queer for us, Nietzsche. Remember, you're a genius. Time was when the church harbored the talents of mankind and furnished inspiration. But artists are a temperamental lot. They don't conform like the common man. Thus hath God said, thou shalt all conform to the church, except the millionaire and the politician. Special arrangements will be made privately for them. The church discovered mathematics and began to play the numbers game and forgot about the artists. And then the nobility, those who could afford the marble and the orchestras and the opera companies and the theaters and the costumes, assumed the burden of the uncommon man. But times soon grew difficult and budgets small. Conversation overheard at dinner. My, doesn't he eat a lot? Where does he get his appetite? All he does is sit around and write poetry. And then came the Industrial Revolution, and the uncommon man could neither spin nor weave, and so out on the street. Freshly writ sonnets, 2 for a quarter, get your freshly written sonnets. And finally for the poet, the friendly 20th century and Hallmark greeting cards. Space and time vary relative to the speed of light. They are not absolute. How absolutely stupid. Is nothing sacred? That terrible Mr. Einstein trying to wreck Isaac's nice, neat Anglican universe. But he does play a lovely violin. Is my favorite. Galileo went out to play on Pisa's Leaning Tower one day. He dropped 2 balls from a measuring cup. Recant, Galileo, or we'll burn you up. Joke. My daughter is dating a philosopher. Response, how nice, what does he do for a living? John Stuart Mill worked for 40 years as a clerk of the East India Company. During coffee breaks, he invented the canons of causal logic on which all subsequent medical research has been based. He also developed an advanced theory of utilitarianism. He was the first to warn of the need to protect the rights of individual citizens against the expanding powers of government. When Mr. Mill retired, the company presented him with a gold watch and a modest pension. Johann Sebastian Bach had 20 children, or was it 21? After a while, you lose count. Of course, he had 2 wives. No wonder he was always Baroque. Who cares for the one-of-a-kind people? Who tolerates their idiosyncrasies and their oddities? Whose obligation is it to feed and care for those whose work, by its very nature, appeals to a very select few? Are they so precious that we can't afford a few? Who should pay for them? The church? The state? The wealthy? The charitable organizations? The foundations? The universities? When in doubt, stick the common man. Therefore, let there be an alliance between the common man and the uncommon man. Let the common man feed the uncommon man, and let the uncommon man uplift the common man. The worker and the artist, there's a combination. Let all future works of art be hung in factories and farms. Let music replace muzak in all the greasy spoons and truck stops. Let all thinkers write for the common man and glorify his history. Then, if ever, the silent voices of the neglected and the unnoticed will speak, and the uncommon man will find an audience to appreciate him, friends to feed him, and most necessary of all, a community where, though not always understood, he is warmly welcomed and always at home.
Thank you. You may now feel free to comment or get ready to do something else before lunch, because that's all I will have to say this morning.
I was wondering, what would we do without this common man anyway?
Well, he wouldn't survive.
Right on.
Nor would we survive without the uncommon man.
Right. You got to have both of them.
Yeah, it's in the line when he said that the common man created the cathedral. Hit me from the angle.
I was using...
Isn't that the uncommon man to mastermind it?
One of the fascinating things about the cathedral is that, you know, there was no master planner, virtually any of them, and they, you know, one generation would build on the ideas of the previous one, and there were a lot, you know, the whole town would work on it, and everybody would do what he could, and there was, it just sort of grew out of them. Now, granted, there were certain people, we don't know who they were, who invented, you know, the Gothic arch and the flying buttress, and they use those engineering ideas, but he's really created just a simple skeleton, and beyond that, you know, people gave of what they could, and they gave anonymously.
Would you, did you have that in mind, the common man creating the cathedral? Would you have that in mind if you were thinking about Michelangelo and the Pope, and the tremendous works in Rome that were created. And would you consider that to be the common man?
No, Mike. Well, now that's St. Peter's is the creation of a number of uncommon men, commissioned by men who were neither common nor uncommon.
How about Westminster Abbey?
Mm-hmm. Westminster Abbey was built in a short period of time. The early part was built in a short period of time, about the 11th century. Yeah, but see, the guys, you can guarantee that you're not dealing with a common man if somebody's name is there. But you can figure that the common man chiseled a name up there. Because the common man is, by his very nature, almost always anonymous. He's not noticed or remembered.
I also want to say I like the construction of your poem. The way you talk about the common men and the uncommon men and the finale or the end of it, both working together as in harmony, and I think that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Do we have reached that point now in our world?
Well, I think we're beginning to in the area of the pictorial artist. Some advance in the area of music. I think part of the problem, though, is that, and that's what I, you know, I didn't emphasize it very heavily, but part of the problem is that I think that the uncommon man has a vast untapped source of ideas in the common man. You know, he's still writing for the nobles of the Renaissance. You know, and he's not, with few exceptions, he's not drawing inspiration from his potential audience and providing something for it as well as he could. Now, we've done some of it, and I think what's tended to happen in literature is literature in the modern age operated with an audience of the nobility, and then very briefly it hit the middle class, and it hit the middle class critically and attacked it, and then it jumped to the proletariat. And so it kind of skipped over the common man.
Could you give some examples of artists who, in your judgment, are drawing from and or speaking to the common man today?
Andrew Wyeth. I think in some of his work Picasso did. It's remarkable with a lot of Picasso how he connects with, you know, the ordinary people. Of course, Picasso always said, "I am a peasant, the richest peasant that ever lived, but, you know, I'm a peasant, I'm a Spanish peasant." And a few others are Rivera, Diego Rivera, I think communicated very well with the Mexican peasants. So there is a movement that way. I think in literature, Hemingway had a kind of a feeling. Now, Hemingway tended probably not to feel at home with the American common man. He felt at home with the Spanish common man, the African common man, and, you know, and so on. And the Caribbean common man, and the fisherman, and so on. But he did connect with the American public, who felt a kind of commonness there. Steinbeck. But most of the literature that's being written in the United States today, I think, is that's getting published, it's changing a bit, but most that's getting published is East Coast stuff. East Coast, New York City elite type stuff. And it, you know, it just doesn't connect in the Midwest.
What can you say about Lincoln's statement about the common man?
I was gonna put another little section in there and use that one as one of the ways whereby we keep the common man satisfied with his lot. And say, well, you know, God loves you, you know, as we steal his stuff away from him and say, but just remember, God loves you. And I thought, well, I'll leave that one out. I like Lincoln. So I didn't put that one in.
How could he rise from being the common man to the uncommon man that he became?
I don't know. Nobody knows. That's why he's such a mystery. We keep trying to explain him. It was impossible. It couldn't have happened. You know, it's, you know, there it is. I think that's one of the reasons why Lincoln not only has an appeal to the American common man, but to the common man around the world. You talk to the Chinese common man, and the Indian common man, and the African common man, and they all know Abraham Lincoln. You know, they feel an affinity with him. He was one of us. And I suppose the cynic says, and of course it was inevitable that he would get killed, because they don't let common men live when they rise above their station. started a tradition a few years ago with Mary Hinderly of making my last lecture at the village Mary Hinderly lecture, and Mary chooses the topic. So this is my last formal lecture at the village since we're leaving tomorrow. And last Sunday, Mary assigned me the topic. But the topic is In Defense of the English Language, subtopic, A Plea for Protection of an Endangered Species. I don't have to tell this learned audience this morning that there is a tremendous ecological concern in the United States. But one of the things we tend not to be concerned about is our common possession, the English language, which for many years has been wasted, slaughtered, sterilized, and bastardized by all many manner of people who don't love it. A living language is like a growing city. It develops with its own kind of vitality and rationale, forming natural orders and internal structures and substructures, and there's no master plan. Here and there one might find a jewel of exquisite charm and grace, a Shakespeare or a Milton or someone of that sort. In other places we find plain, workaday, utilitarian sections which are rugged and sturdy. Alongside heavy commercial areas where there is a great deal going on, we tend to find streets which are wearing out and dwellings which are scarcely habitable, giving scant comfort and use to their inhabitants. And beyond them lie the empty shells of worn-out buildings no longer able to bring comfort or use to people. And so also we find words which no longer mean anything. Some sections of every large city have been enriched by aliens moving in and forming alien sections and styles, which exist for a time in isolation and then are gradually intertwined and blended with the rest of the city. And the same thing happens to a living language as foreign language elements become a part of it. Every living language contains almost limitless possibilities for expression if it is not abused. And abuse tends to come in three varieties: straitjacketing the language, overusing it, and perverting it. I'm going to talk about those three topics this morning. Number one, straitjacketing the language, the crime of the English professor and International Business Machine Corporation. Somewhere, sometime during the last century, some nameless German philologist decided that all languages ought to be analyzed and taught scientifically according to a precise formula. He may very well also have been the same man who invented the Tinker toy. For he decided that all language is divisible into parts called words, and all words are divisible into parts called letters. And if we take words and put them together in certain combinations, behold, we get larger wholes called sentences. And if we take those sentences and put them together in appropriate ways, we get paragraphs. And if we arrange those paragraphs in proper order, we get doctor's dissertations. Having made this fantastic discovery, he decided that the task of the language teacher was to teach people how to put together such structures and how to analyze structures which people who are good at putting structures together put them together so that they could get better at putting such structures together. We call this the classical approach to language because it is based upon the model of Latin. Latin, as we all know, is a dead language. Imagine taking the vitality of English and German and French and Spanish and Russian and trying to match them to a corpse. Imagine the United States Forestry Service deciding that all trees in the forest that don't work in a certain kind of way should have corsets put on them so that they grow right. Or suppose in a class in tree science, the instructor would present the topic tree and would say, a tree is composed of one trunk, at one end of which are attached anywhere from 5 to 10 roots. At the other end are attached anywhere from 2 to 12 branches, to each of which are attached from 2 to 500 leaves. Is that a tree? In the latter part of the last century, there were some mathematical philosophers who decided that the English language was too sloppy. They drew this conclusion because they found they couldn't reduce it to mathematical logic, which they had just invented. And so they felt that a new language needed to be invented that wasn't nearly so sloppy and casual and abstruse. And so they invented one. As a matter of fact, they invented a number of them. Artificial languages. Each one of these was perfect, easily comprehensible, easily learned, a model of simplicity, and dead, like Latin. In recent years, IBM and like corporations have invented computer language based on mathematical logic. And they have attempted to translate English into computer language. Thus far, they have not succeeded, particularly with such common linguistic English forms as the Bronx cheer. And until they do, we are all comparatively safe. I personally call such attempts to straitjacket the language, language fascism. Living languages do not follow mathematical structures, although they do follow rules. They're like forests. The trees within a forest develop in relation to one another. And in order to understand a particular forest, you have to study the trees and how they relate to one another. The only place where you can find trees growing in mathematical order is in tree farms. Now, in recent years, we have finally begun to appreciate that languages have their own living structures, and that it is by means of their unique structures that we gain a sense of reality and of meaning. The more broadly we become acquainted with our own language, the richer our understanding of our manner of existence grows. We become acquainted with our language by means of our language, not by forcing an alien order upon it and expecting it to conform, or by tearing it apart and see what makes it tick. Only a fool would dig up Holden Lake Meadows and reorganize the vegetation into a more recognizable order. And yet, more often than not, we have attempted to do this with our language, which is no less delicate an environment. Topic, oh, I got a footnote here that I wrote in later, so I can't go on topic number two. My favorite topic. Let me talk briefly on the subject of definition. No group of academics meeting to discuss some subject can meet very long before someone will ask to have the terms defined, right? Let's define our terms. This is a ploy. A ploy which is frequently exercised by people who have nothing to say but who wish to appear brilliant. Invariably at this point, all intelligent conversation ceases while the terms are being defined. And from that moment on, all hope of reaching any kind of useful conclusion is lost. It is though people were to have to decide who they were before they could act or say anything. Or perhaps
have a haircut in order to make themselves more clear and precise. Words, except for the artificial words of logic, mathematics, and science, don't have definitions. They have careers. To ask for the definition of terms is simply to ask what proscribed and limited roles during our succeeding conversation we wish certain words to play. And having decided on the roles we wish those words to play, we usually have also predetermined the plot. And any surprises which we might encounter are automatically excluded. Part 2, Overuse. The Crime of Madison Avenue. Language expresses ideas and values. The spoken language more richly expresses them than the written language, but each form is capable of more subtlety than any logic we have ever devised. We conventionally recognize a cognitive and an emotive side of language, well aware that no sharp distinction can ever be drawn between the two, for each side tends to fertilize and enrich the other. Together, they give language its vitality and its significance. But like a street or a building, overuse can wear them out. When a word is worn out, its capacity to express an idea or a subtle nuance of feeling is gone. We wear out words by overusing them. Now, we expect a certain amount of wearing out of language to occur. As a matter of fact, we are always inventing certain language which we expect to wear out. It's invented for temporary use. We call it slang. It fits a particular time or place, and then it disappears. It never makes the dictionary. And years afterwards, we who used it when we were at a certain age recall it with nostalgia and humor. But in recent years, we have been wearing out non-slang words at an alarming rate. To a great extent, because of the plethora of mass advertising and mass media, which consume words as well as ideas at an alarming rate. Let me give you some examples. Good, beautiful, powerful, superlative, outstanding, lovely. Practically dead words today. Only by putting a great deal of energy into our expression of those words, beautiful, can we resurrect a portion of the vitality which they once expressed all by themselves. We call sentences composed of these kinds of words tired sentences. They don't have much life anymore. By the way, we have tended to do the same kind of thing to much of our theological vocabulary. For instance, the words God, sin, inspiration, awe. And so we search for new words to recapture the original ideas that those words expressed by themselves. Number 3, perversion of language. The sin of the academics and the activists. Language can become perverted in at least two kinds of ways. One, by the substitution of artificial language for natural language, where natural language is perfectly capable of functioning. And two, by the use of normative language non-normatively, and vice versa. Ever since Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, academics have found ordinary language incapable of expressing their newly discovered complexity. As a result, they are constantly how to translate it into ordinary English. The academics talk artificial language to one another in their discipline, which everybody rapidly translates into ordinary English in his mind, and then he talks artificial language back to the next guy. One suspects, and I'm being a bit uncharitable here, one suspects that if ordinary language were used, the ideas would be exposed as rather trivial and ordinary. We all know which disciplines are the prime offenders. Bad as many of them are, they have all been outstripped in recent years by the new language of computerese. This spring, all the administrators at my college received a message from the computer center. In the coy fashion typical of such places, the message, two lengthy paragraphs on computer paper, purported to come from the computer itself. I spent 20 minutes deciphering it, and when I had finished deciphering it, it said that no work was going to be done the following Wednesday in the computer center while the machinery was being oiled. Now, why couldn't they have said that? Then there are the ideologists and the ethicists, ever since Karl Marx, who talk in private code to one another. They use language not to communicate and to create understanding, but to shock. They spit out words as though they were bullets. And the technique is really rather simple. Use a word which is heavily loaded with all kinds of emotive significance, although it weren't, as though it weren't. Or use a word which has no kind of emotive significance at all, and use it as though it were, had some sinister or sublime significance. I'll give you some examples. Using a loaded word as though it were non-loaded. Several years ago, a friend of mine, and as I mentioned this, some of you will know who I mean, was lecturing here, and he kept referring to white people as racist. And after a while, I asked him what he meant. He had just met me, and I was white, and how he knew I was racist, I sure didn't know. But I asked him what he meant by this universal statement. And he said, well, what he really meant was that in the United States, the nature of society right now is such that the color of a man's skin cannot be a matter of indifference. Well, we agree, right? Perfectly innocuous statement, no motive overtones at all. I said, but look, the word racist is a heavily loaded emotive word, meaning people who are biased, strongly biased. And he replied, oh, but I don't use it that way. The other bit, taking words which have virtually no emotive content and loading them up with emotional content. Black, red, capitalist, communist, chauvinist, pig, liberal, conservative. All of these words originally had virtually no emotional implication at all. Very useful words to identify things or explain things. Innocent little words. Very useful to express ideas about which nobody felt particularly strong. But not today. One handles them quite gingerly, because all manner of emotive content has artificially been pumped into each one of us. I feel particularly bad about the word pig. And I'll tell you why. The word swine was once a very useful word, until we started to use it to identify human gluttons, behaving in ways no self-respecting pig would ever behave. So out went swine. You couldn't use that one anymore. Sow became a fat, sloppy girl. Pig is now a policeman. Pray tell, what am I going to say to my butcher someday when meat prices come down? Shall I be reduced to pointing to this or that cut of meat because there aren't any words left that identify P-O-R-K? As our campaigns for social change go on, we render more and more of our language unacceptable for ordinary use. And where violence is done to the language loses its capacity to serve as the very means of resolving the issues which separate us. In a very real sense, people today are in shock and disoriented because their familiar linguistic surroundings have been disrupted, inflamed, and dislocated. And it is for these reasons that I plead this morning on behalf of the English language. I grant that the English language does not need to be coddled or babied, but it does need to be respected. We Americans are related to one another by one of the most sophisticated and subtle languages ever developed among men. And there are many who think that it is the greatest language which has ever developed. Since we Americans seem determined to be a one-language people, with the exception of a few Norwegians, we had best not inhibit or despoil it. It's the only language we got. Our intellectual and our cultural capacities extend only so far as our language's versatility and vitality. By way of contrast, our British cousins give us a noble example. One need but hear someone from the British tradition speak to recognize immediately his sensitivity to every nuance within the language. The way he cherishes every syllable, savors every sounded consonant, and resonates every vowel, testifies to his love for his native tongue. Each sentence is an oral genuflection toward the sacred altar of English. Small wonder that the British are linguistic betters. An ancient people once resolved to build a monument to the greatness of man. But before very long, the architects were beginning to talk architectese, and the contractors were talking contractorese, and the stonemasons were talking stonemason talk. As the monument got higher and higher, they developed 20th-story stonemason talk as opposed to 30th-story stonemason talk, and so on. And finally, they were all just standing around hollering at one another. One of them, exhausted by all of the noise, decided that he would return home to his loving wife. He knocked on the door. She opened it. "I'm home, dear," he said, smiling sweetly. "Kunig verstehen," she replied, slamming the door in his face. To the English language, long may it survive. Right, we are ready for you to talk. So any of you that don't know Mary, Mary's back in the corner. That's Mistress Mary, Mistress of the Arts. Everyone knows that Carol is the abbot and Mary is the abbess.
We talked about the street chanting in the way of thinking about the cliff, you know, down to the cliff, because it's really, you wanted to keep the English language pure. And this is where we do run into the problem, I guess, if we suggested the idea of street chanting. How do you control something that is living? Dictionary, and of course it was useless within a very short time, and because of the fact that you tried to say that, you wanted to say words are pure English, and any deviations from these words or very few of this English dictionary are definitely deviations and are sins against the language. All the English departments have since made fun of this, but no one has come up with any better way.
I think there are two primary things we have to concentrate on. I think one of the problems that English profs oftentimes have had, and I think most of them have, are very sensitive to this area today. But one of the problems that English profs have tended to have was they unconsciously tended to think of English as written classics, and we must now somehow or other freeze the language at some point so that people can always read Shakespeare with understanding. And there's been a kind of a utilitarian unconscious motivation going on there. If we have to my way of thinking, that there are two things we have to be concerned with a living language. The one is that it retains its capacity for communication. And the other one is that as much as possible, it has the capacity for us to draw from it all manner of literary treasures. Now that it's a working language which we can use beautifully as well as adequately. And English is particularly good at this. Kind of at low ebb right now, I suppose, because the writers are a little bit afraid of the other media people and don't quite know what to do about it. Or maybe the best minds are going into the media rather than into English from a production standpoint. Yes?
In that communication and reading, what would you say about, well, what I hear you saying now is that, if I'm hearing you right, in that whole, I don't know, I'm interested in the management context of you, whether it's hearing, you know, primarily how most of us use language to express what you'd like to use together.
Not when you're bawling out John.
Yes, I don't want to.
You're attacking him verbally.
For whatever reason, people use
this. Well, there's a great deal. I mentioned this, and your mama talked to me about that last Sunday when she asked me about doing this topic. There's a great deal of flagellating other groups going on today under the guise of communication, you know, and people hollering at one another and using language to whip the other side instead of to communicate. And we've converted it from communication to rhetoric. And we just hurl our rhetoric at one another. And the process of which we begin to create all kinds of good words and dirty words that were neutral words before. And whenever we tend to do this sort of thing, there's a lot of language that can't get used anymore.
In the Missouri Senate, you dare not be either today. These are both. Well, in one group, liberal is a good word, conservative is a bad word. In another group, liberal is a bad word, conservative is a good word. And you say, "I'm a liberal conservative." Can't be. You got to be one or the other, or neither. But liberal is a good word, and conservative is a good word. But we load them up with so much heat and intensity that they're unusable.